Can beauty save the world? You might think that the answer should be yes, at least at a Thomistic Institute talk, given something Pope Benedict once said. Art and the saints, he claimed, are the greatest apologetics for our faith. Since the poet makes beautiful things, and the saint has a beautiful soul, perhaps we should conclude that poets and saints should be peopling the Marvel Cinematic Universe, rather than with all those other so-called superheroes. This evening, I'd like to think seriously about Pope Benedict's claim and how beauty might contribute to world salvation. We could begin thinking about the importance of beauty in many ways. I would like to start with the doctrine of the transcendentals, developed by the medieval scholastics. And just, if you'll permit me, how many of you have heard of the phrase the transcendentals as a philosophical concept? Okay. Bear with me here for the next few minutes. According to St. Thomas Aquinas, for example, there are certain universal characteristics of everything that exists, simply insofar as it exists. These characteristics don't add anything to the existence of something, the way we would say that standing up here in front of all of you adds something to my being. Yesterday I wasn't here, now I am. Instead, as Aquinas says, some predicates may be said to add to being inasmuch as they express a mode of being, not expressed by the word being. Some of these predicates are common to all beings insofar as they are beings. And there's two ways this happens. First, he says, insofar as it follows upon every being considered absolutely. And second, insofar as it follows upon every being considered in relation to another. Examples of the first include thing. Great titles for these things. Thing. Every being is a thing, meaning that it has a certain essence or whatness. And one. Every being is in some sense one, undivided, unified as a distinct existent. But some predicates are common to all beings, not considered absolutely, but considered in relation to other beings. Something, for example, names all beings insofar as they are some other thing in relation to everything else. Some of these predicates include even more. They are based on the correspondence one being has with another. These attributes of beings as such reveal a very deep connection between different existing things. The two attributes that Aquinas discusses here are goodness and truth. Good, he says, expresses the correspondence of being to the appetitive power, our desire. For, and so we note in the Ethics, and here he's referring to Aristotle's Ethics, the good is that which all desire. True, on the other hand, expresses the correspondence of being to the knowing power, for all knowing is produced by an assimilation of the knower to the thing known, so that assimilation is said to be the cause of knowledge. The upshot of all this is that for Aquinas, all things, insofar as they exist, are good. Evil, according to this way of thinking, is not anything really existing. It is an absence of existence. And all things, insofar as they exist, are true. Ultimately, all things that exist correspond at least to the mind of God. I haven't yet mentioned beauty, for the simple reason that Aquinas did not include beauty in the list of transcendentals. In fact, no medieval list of transcendentals includes beauty. I've often wondered how Aquinas' thought might have changed, actually, in this regard, had he read more Plato. Though we knew Aristotle's texts backwards and forwards, there was very little of Plato's writings available when Aquinas was alive. And of course, beauty has a special place in Plato's thought. Plato's recovered in the West during the Renaissance, and it's during the Renaissance that the trinity of truth, beauty, and goodness becomes a commonplace. It was not until the 20th century, in the work of the Catholic philosopher Jacques Maritain, that beauty was systematically developed as a member of the Scholastic Transcendentals. His book, Art and Scholasticism, published in 1920, was extraordinarily influential in this regard. It was the book, for example, that the Catholic novelist and short story writer Flannery O'Connor cut her aesthetic teeth on, as she says. Maritain surrounded himself for much of his life with artists, writers, poets, sculptors, and others devoted to the life of beauty, and he gave them in his slim book a way to connect their lives to the highest levels of mystical reality. Maritain begins by reminding us that Aquinas defined beauty as that which pleases when seen. Id quod visum placet. As Maritain says, these four words, four Latin words, not the five English ones, these four words say all that is necessary, a vision, that is to say, an intuitive knowledge, and a joy. The beautiful is what gives joy. Not all joy, but joy in knowledge. Not that joy peculiar to the act of knowing, but a joy superabounding and overflowing from such an act because of the object known. He continues, if a thing exalts and delights the soul by the bare fact of its being given to the intuition of the soul, it is good to apprehend, then it is beautiful. Beauty, therefore, according to Maritain, is the transcendental that combines goodness and truth. That which is good is desirable, it pleases us, and that which is true is apprehended by us in a vision that corresponds to reality. The beautiful is therefore the pleasing goodness of a reality made known to us. If Maritain is right that beauty is a transcendental, and I at least for one am convinced that he is, then ultimately, beauty names God himself. Just as God is truth and goodness, so God is also beauty. Reflecting on this, Maritain quotes a passage from the 19th century French poet Charles Baudelaire. It is that immortal instinct for the beautiful which makes us consider the world and its pageants as a glimpse of, a correspondence with heaven. The insatiable thirst for everything beyond, which life reveals, is the liveliest proof of our immortality. It is at once by poetry and through poetry, by music and through music, that the soul perceives what splendors shine behind the tomb. And when an exquisite poem brings tears to the eyes, such tears do not argue an excess of enjoyment, but rather attest an irritation of melancholy, some peremptory need of the nerves, a nature exiled in the imperfect, which would fain possess immediately, even on this earth, a paradise revealed. Beauty, for philosophers like Maritain and poets like Baudelaire, delights us, draws us in, pulls us up, out of our everyday lives, and into the realm of the eternal. But so does goodness, and so does truth. That's what it means, after all, to be a transcendental that picks out relations between existing things. There is, I think, more than a hint of potential rivalry here between these three. After all, what life would be best for you? The life of the mystic in pursuit of truth? The life of the poet in pursuit of beauty? Or the life of the saint in search of goodness? Here's one form of this potential rivalry. There's an ancient quarrel between poetry and philosophy, Plato wrote in his Republic. For such expressions, he says, as the bitch yelping at its master and howling and great in the empty eloquence of fools, and controlled by a mob of the omniwise, probably my favorite one, and the subtle thinkers who are beggars all, and countless others are signs of this old opposition. Plato has Socrates banish the poets from his ideal city, since if they are allowed in, pleasure and pain will be kings in our city instead of law in the thing that has always been generally believed to be best, reason. In turn, by the time Plato wrote, Socrates himself had already been the comic butt of Greece's most famous funny man, Aristophanes. In Plato's Apology, Socrates describes Aristophanes as one of his old accusers, partly responsible for his execution. A fact Socrates alludes to again in the Republic in the allegory of the cave, when he suggests that philosophers will first be mocked and then killed. We have 11 comic plays by Aristophanes, and though Socrates in philosophy appear in a number of them, he's the star of the show, so to speak, in the third, The Clouds, first performed probably in 423 BC, 24 years before Socrates' trial and execution. In The Clouds, Socrates appears as a priest of subtlish hogwash who robs and corrupts his students before being burned to death on the top of his thinkery, set alight by a disgruntled father whose son returned home having learned only how to argue in defense of beating up his own parents. One important question at the center of this rivalry between poetry and philosophy, or we might say between the pursuit of beauty and the pursuit of wisdom, is this: what gives us human beings the best insight into what is most real? On the one hand, perhaps rational reflection, expressed most fully in the purity of the life of wisdom, yields the most satisfying results. On the other hand, perhaps artistic sensitivity, the kind of awareness experienced by Dante, Jane Austen, or J.R.R. Tolkien, allows us to see most deeply into the life of things. Our desire for a connection with what is most real as the heart of a life well lived is an important part of Plato's Republic, where Socrates argues that the poet is three times removed from reality. The philosopher is involved with what is most real, the ideal forms of things, like beauty itself. The artisan with those material objects that are in second place, like a beautiful piece of furniture. And the artist or poet with what is least real, a poem or a story about real material objects that are themselves copies of the ideal form. This problem is likewise on Aristophanes' mind, and his caricature of Socrates is a familiar one. Socrates is interested in irrelevant minutiae, far removed from the real business of human life, and if he were really honest with himself, he would see that his intellectual posturing is just a mask for the private pursuit of personal gain. What's so great about the ivory tower? 3 months off every summer. To help us reflect on this potential rivalry over our insight into what is most real, between beauty and goodness and wisdom, I'd like to bring Plato's student Aristotle into conversation with Shakespeare for the next few minutes. Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, crucial source for, among other things, the moral philosophy of St. Thomas Aquinas, and the recent revival of classical ethics, and championed by many, if not all, of the speakers for the Thomistic Institute, myself included, identifies magnanimity as a special virtue that is a sort of crown of the virtues, for it makes them greater, he says. It is not found without them. Magnanimity, or having a great soul, is a very interesting virtue. Unlike courage, temperance, justice, and prudence, magnanimity deals with great things and great honors on a grand scale. Someone is magnanimous if he thinks himself worthy of great things, being worthy of them. Whereas he who is worthy of little and thinks himself worthy of little is temperate, but not magnanimous, for magnanimity implies greatness. The honor due to the best is most of all the concern of the great-souled man, and he is good in the highest degree, for the better man always deserves more, he says, and the best man most. Perhaps my favorite characteristics of all, a slow step is thought proper to the magnanimous man, a deep voice, and a level utterance, for the man who takes few things seriously is not likely to be hurried, nor the man who thinks nothing great to be excited, while a shrill voice and a rapid gait or the results of hurry and excitement. Consider also this provocative description by Aristotle of the magnanimous man. He's the sort of man to confer benefits, but he is ashamed of receiving them. For the one is the mark of a superior, the other of an inferior. And he's apt to confer greater benefits in return, for thus the original benefactor, besides being paid, will incur a debt to him and will be the gainer by the transaction. They seem also, again this is Aristotle, to remember any service they have done, but not those they have received. For he who receives a service is inferior to him who has done it. But the magnanimous man wishes to be superior, and to hear of the former with pleasure, of the latter with displeasure. It is a mark of the magnanimous man also to ask for nothing or scarcely anything, but to give help readily. All this is what is more proper to a character that suffices to itself. For Aristotle, the magnanimous man is as self-sufficient as a human being can be. Self-sufficiency is a mark of superiority. The less dependent one is on others, the greater that person is. And hence the magnanimous man enjoys conferring benefits on others. It's rather a pleasure, isn't it, to lavish gifts on our friends out of our largesse, and prefers not to remember the favors they have received. I'd really rather not dwell on how indebted I am to my friends. It's a reminder of how needy, how weak I am. Aristotle's magnanimous man has provoked some interesting responses in the history of philosophy. But I want to spend some time thinking about the reflections on magnanimity expressed in Shakespeare's great tragedy, Coriolanus. Have any of you read Coriolanus? I warmly recommend it to you. T.S. Eliot's favorite Shakespeare play, by the way. Written around 1608, less than 10 years before his death, and perhaps Shakespeare's last tragedy, Coriolanus tells the story of the legendary Roman leader, Caius Marcius Coriolanus, thought to have lived in the 5th century BC during a time of struggle between the Romans and their enemy, the Volscians. The basics of the plot are these. The play opens shortly after the expulsion of the Tarquin kings and the beginning of the Roman Republic. The common people are rioting and demanding grain, and they blame the patricians, Coriolanus in particular, for their suffering. Coriolanus is contemptuous of them, but before matters come to a head, he leaves Rome after news arrives that a Volscian army has taken the field. Coriolanus is a masterful soldier, and almost single-handedly brings about the fall of the Volscian city of Coriolis, for which he's given the honorific title, Coriolanus. Back in Rome, he's encouraged by his family and friends to run for consul, the highest office in Rome, and easily wins the support of the Senate. But when he's required to win the support of the people by showing them his wounds as proof of his love for the city, he refuses. And after another angry mob is fomented by the representatives of the people, the tribunes Brutus and Sicinius, Coriolanus is exiled. Seeking vengeance, he allies himself with the Volscians and leads their army against Rome itself. Rome, terrified by the Volscian army outside its gates, sends Coriolanus's mother, wife, and child to him to persuade him to stand down. Coriolanus, emphatically refusing at first, eventually gives in and withdraws the army, only to be struck down by the Volscians shortly afterwards in return for his betrayal. Coriolanus is the consummately magnanimous man. He prefers a noble life over a long one, disdains material goods in favor of honor and glory, and despises flattery. I am constant, he says, for he keeps his word. He is uninterested in the spoils of war and refuses rewards. His friend Menenius says of him, he's too noble for the world. Cominius, another friend and fellow general, says, the deeds of Coriolanus should not be uttered feebly. It is held that valor is the chiefest virtue and most dignifies the haver, If it be the man I speak of cannot in the world be single, counterpoised, that is, cannot be equaled. And like the magnanimous man, Coriolanus aspires to self-sufficiency and resists taking on and later acknowledging any debts to others. When he shows himself to the people in order to receive their support for his election to consul, he's asked what brings him before them. Rather than say he's come to ask for their votes, he replies merely, "Mine own desert brought me here." He simply overlooks the custom of showing his wounds to the people as evidence of his love for them. And we should not be surprised, for he said earlier that he would rather have his wounds heal again than hear say how he got them. After conquering Coriolis, he pauses and somewhat surprisingly asks a favor of his then general, Cominius. "I sometime lay here in Coriolis at a poor man's house. He used me kindly. He cried to me. I saw him prisoner. I request you to give my poor host freedom." "Oh, well begged," says Cominius, and asks only for his name. But Coriolanus replies, "By Jupiter, forgot." So much for acknowledging and returning favors. His desires are summarized beautifully in his cry at the end of the play that he would stand as if a man were author of himself. And in a strange way, he is his own author in this story, since he is responsible for the fall of Coriolis, emerging bloody and alone from the entrance to the city, like a newborn child, and drawing down upon himself in consequence a new name, Coriolanus. In this play, Shakespeare thinks about dependence and independence and the power and failure of Coriolanus' character, primarily through the imagery of eating and drinking. Our most primordial need is the need for food and drink, and an image of this dependency appears in the opening scene of the play. "There was a time when all the body's members rebelled against the belly, thus accused it, that only like a gulf it did remain in the midst of the body, idle and unactive, still coveting the vein, never bearing like labor with the rest, where the other instruments did see and hear, devise, instruct, walk, feel, and mutually participate, did minister unto the appetite and affection common of the whole body. The belly answered, 'True is it, my incorporate friends, that I receive the general food at first which you do live upon, and fit it is, because I am the storehouse and the shop of the whole body. But if you do remember, I send it through the rivers of your blood, even to the court, the heart, to the seat of the brain, and through the cranks and offices of man, the strongest nerves and small inferior veins from me receive that natural competency whereby they live.'" This fable is told first to the common people, remind them that although the patricians don't seem to do much, like the belly, they are crucial for the life of the rest of the body. But later in the play, the analogy is reversed, and Coriolanus compares the people themselves to a monster of many stomachs. Each character, it seems, is in one sense the stomach, and in another one of the extremities. Each is sustained by, and in turn sustains, the other. This ideal of interdependence is systematically frustrated by the action of the play. Rather than a unified body taking in food from the outside that sustains its common life, the most common image of eating here is cannibalism. One citizen exclaims that if the wars eat us not up, the patricians will. According to Coriolanus, the plebeians feed on one another and are nothing but fragments, that is, food scraps. When Coriolanus enters Coriolis all alone, the soldiers exclaim that he has been shut up in the pot, meaning the stew pot. Later, wolves that would consume the lamb are compared to the hungry plebeians who would consume the noble Coriolanus. But later, Coriolanus himself is twice compared to a wolf over against the people. In another lovely detail, Shakespeare never shows us Coriolanus eating or drinking. Indeed, when he leads the Volscian army against Rome at the end of the play, his friends wish to find him having recently eaten, since then, so they think, they might find him more agreeable to their pleas on behalf of the city. But Coriolanus never obliges. This magnanimous man prefers to do away with even the most basic of human dependencies. It's only when his mother begs of him on her knees, herself a striking visual reminder of the very deepest and most primordial of all nourishing dependencies, that of the unborn child nourished inside its mother, that he weakens. And in that moment, no longer a terrible god, he becomes a man again. He gives up the siege, and he's struck down by the Volscians in revenge for his weakness. A tragic end, yes, but not as tragic as it could have been. He pulled back from destroying Rome herself. Cannibalism on a national scale. Shakespeare's play helps me say a number of important things connected to my theme this evening. A disciple of wisdom, Aristotle, and a disciple of beauty, Shakespeare, are both thinking about the pursuit of goodness. They agree on the admitted grandeur, even godliness, of independence, as well as the special achievement such independence would represent if possessed by a human being. But whereas Aristotle seems to think that magnanimity does not pose any particularly difficult problems as an expression of the highest virtuous achievement, Shakespeare sees magnanimity as a potent source of the eventual unraveling of a virtuous life. His argument is made by insisting on the inherent dependencies of human life and suggesting what might happen were a human being to pretend to self-sufficiency. Such a person striving against all dependencies, though dependent nonetheless for all that, would end in self-destruction, unwilling to eat or drink and thus reveal his neediness, but still needing nourishment. Coriolanus has no recourse besides self-cannibalism, to feed his needs with himself, a self-destroying self-sufficiency. Shakespeare, therefore, allows us to test Aristotle's claims about the moral life. Here, Aristotle comes off rather badly, I think, but in other circumstances, philosophy might claim the victory. On the surface, I've been considering how the wise man and the poet might criticize one another in the pursuit of insight into deep human realities. And so I've been reinforcing the rivalry described by Plato and suggested by my initial list of transcendentals. But in order to say anything meaningful about Coriolanus, in order, that is, to know how to think about Coriolanus, and then to go on from Coriolanus himself, we must make use of the resources of philosophical reflection. To steal a line from David O'Connor, whose recent book, Plato's Bedroom, all of you should order once you return home this evening, and who in turn is playing upon a line from Kant, philosophy without literature is empty. Literature without philosophy is blind. We cannot know what to think of Aristotle's magnanimous man until we can see him living and breathing before us, clothed in flesh. And we cannot know what to make of a living, breathing man without the abstract reflection that characterizes philosophy. It was no accident that I chose Aristotle and Shakespeare on magnanimity, since both wisdom and beauty and goodness might seek independence for themselves, aspiring to the supreme achievement of self-sufficient greatness, and as a result, I think, inevitably tumble into narcissistic self-absorption, ending in self-cannibalism. We should therefore think of wisdom, poetry, and sanctity as each offering complementary and mutually corrective insights into reality. Each one needs the other, and each of us needs all three. But there is another way to think about the potential rivalry between wisdom, beauty, and goodness that raises, I think, deeper problems. Plato, who represented so beautifully for us so many important human questions, gives the love of beauty a special place in our lives. According to Socrates in the Symposium, it is by means of the love of beautiful things that we eventually ascend to beauty itself, what will become God for Christianity. But each of us also in turn yearns to give birth in the beautiful, as he says, meaning that we long to unite with what is beautiful and bring forth fruit from our union. Lovers have children, and philosophers and poets write books or teach students. This means we face a choice. Should we aim for the contemplative rest we might find in the beautiful itself, or should we seek to create our own beautiful things? This is a different kind of rivalry between wisdom and beauty and goodness. At times it has been expressed by the divide between the active life and the contemplative life. Martha, Martha, you are anxious and troubled about many things. One thing is needful. Mary has chosen the good portion, which shall not be taken away from her. So said Jesus in the Gospel of Luke, when Martha complained that her sister Mary wanted simply to sit at the Lord's feet rather than help with the tasks of hosting. And that image of the contemplative life as superior to the active life has worked its way into much of the Christian intellectual tradition. Isn't it better to gaze on the face of Christ than to paint a picture of it or write a play? How can we think of artists as achieving anything better than second best? Or again, picking up on a way that Plato's thoughts in the Symposium are reflected in the development of the Christian tradition. Isn't religious life better than married life? Better is it not to marry God, to join oneself to the beautiful, than to marry someone else and give birth to one's own fairly diminished beautiful things? Plato had no problem with the shadows in the cave. They're necessary, like beautiful people and works of poetry. But they are to be transcended. They're means only towards something greater. And blessed are they who can turn from the shadows to real things and finally to the real source of all. I think the writer J.R.R. Tolkien can help us think about this problem in some provocative and helpful ways. And here I hope Tolkien needs no introduction. Let me know in the discussion period if you'd like me to say more about it. Tolkien was inspired as a scholar and as an artist by the sagas and myths of the old Northern Europeans. The body of literature written down in Old Norse, Old Icelandic, or the same language, in the 13th and 14th centuries is a remarkable collection of mythological poetry, legends, and intensely passionate and personal human stories of achievement and suffering. The Poetic Edda and the Prose Edda describe the creation of the world and the growth of the world tree, the birth of dwarves, elves, giants, and the gods, Odin, Thor, Loki, among many others. These names might ring a bell. The roots of the Marvel Cinematic Universe are here, as well as some of Game of Thrones. The sagas, most famously of all, Njal's Saga and the Saga of the Volsungs, tell family stories of farm life, marriages and wars, blood feuds and revenge. They give us a world at once both violent and deeply human. Njal's Saga, by the way, made a deep impression on the Norwegian Catholic writer Sigrid Undset. Does that name ring a bell for any of you? Won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1928, mostly for her two long novels, Kristin Lavrin's Daughter and the Master of Hestvika. She, in some ways, rewrites Njal's Saga as a Christian in a way similar to the way Tolkien rewrites the Saga of Volsungs and Norse mythology more generally. In order to return to the problem I'm interested in, the potential rivalry between wisdom and beauty and goodness, I want to consider two short works by Tolkien, each written while he was in the midst of writing The Lord of the Rings. His short story, Leif by Niggle, and the essay On Fairy Stories. Each in its own way is a consideration of the Lord of the Rings, and also a consideration of his own activity as a literary artist. In On Fairy Stories, the 1939 Andrew Lang Lecture at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, Tolkien tried to explain what he himself aimed at in his fiction. Fairy, the realm or state in which fairies have their being, contains many things besides elves and fays, fairies, and besides dwarves, witches, trolls, giants, or dragons. It holds the seas, the sun, the moon, the sky, and the earth, and all things that are in it, tree and bird, water and stone, wine and bread, and ourselves, mortal men, when we are enchanted. Most good fairy stories, he continues, are about the adventures of men in the perilous realm or upon its shadowy marches. The perilous realm is not exactly Earth, though it must involve people, and so Tolkien rules outside of fairyland all travel tales like Gulliver's Journey to Lilliput, and dream tales like Lewis Carroll's Alice stories, and beast fables like Beatrix Potter's Peter Rabbit. Fairy begins, says Tolkien, in what we would now call fantasy, where the author becomes a sub-creator, a very important term for him. This aspect of mythology, he says, sub-creation, rather than either representation or symbolic interpretation of the beauties and terrors of the world, is, I think, too little considered. Sub-creation in fairy stories is, he says, plainly not primarily concerned with possibility, but with desirability. If these stories awaken desire, satisfying it while often whetting it unbearably, they succeed. The land of Merlin and Arthur was better. Here he's speaking of his own childhood, better when he was a boy, than the wilderness of bows and arrows. And best of all, the nameless north of Sigurd of the Volsungs and the prince of all dragons. Such lands were preeminently desirable. The dragon had the trademark of fairy written plain upon him. In whatever world he had his being, it was an other world. Fantasy, the making or glimpsing of other worlds, was the heart of the desire of fairy. The world that contained even the imagination of the dragon Fafnir was richer and more beautiful at whatever cost of peril. The dweller in the quiet and fertile plains may hear of the tormented hills and the unharvested sea and long for them in his heart. Even more for Tolkien, that the images of fantastic subcreation are of things not in the primary world is a virtue, not a vice. Fantasy in this sense is, I think, says Tolkien, not a lower but a higher form of art, indeed the most nearly pure form, and so when achieved the most potent. Finally, to the elvish craft enchantment, fantasy aspires. And when it is successful, of all forms of human art most nearly approaches. At the heart of many man-made stories of the elves lies open or concealed, pure or alloyed, the desire for a living, realized, subcreative art. We could spend a long time considering Tolkien's claims on behalf of fairy stories, as he describes them. What's most important for me tonight is his description of his craft as subcreation. This was surely on Tolkien's mind when he wrote just a few years later in 1942 the short story Leaf by Niggle. Niggle is a little man who had a long journey to make, but he did not want to go, and he put off his preparations. He was also a painter, though not a very good one. One picture in particular eventually captured all his attention. It had begun with a leaf caught in the wind, writes Tolkien, and it became a tree. Then all round the tree and behind it, through the gaps in the leaves and boughs, a country began to open out, and there were glimpses of a forest marching over the land, and of mountains tipped with snow. Niggle lost interest in his other pictures, and his canvas for this picture grew so that he needed a ladder to reach the top portions. When neighbors called, he was polite, but underneath he was always thinking of his painting. As time went on, his garden became neglected, and Niggle's time became even more precious as his troublesome journey grew closer. One day, his neighbor Parrish knocked and begged Niggle to go to town for the doctor for his sick wife, he himself being unable to go because of his lame leg. Niggle went, cursing under his breath, and fetched the doctor in the middle of a storm. Parrish's wife, of course, turned out not sick at all. Parrish and his wife were accustomed to ask many favors of Niggle for the sake of their own convenience. But Niggle caught a terrible cold and hadn't yet recovered before the driver came to take him on his long-awaited journey. After some years in a hospital where he's made to do various jobs, and which eventually he does very well, he's sent to the country. Upon arrival, he falls off his bicycle, for before him stands the tree, his tree, finished. If you could say that of a tree that was alive, its leaves opening, its branches growing and bending in the wind, that Nigel had so often felt or guessed and had so often failed to catch. He gazed at the tree, and slowly he lifted his arms and opened them wide. "It's a gift," he said. He was referring to his art and also to the results, but he was using the word quite literally. After some time improving the land, Parrish himself joins him at his tree. "Nigel's picture," says Parrish in astonishment. "Did you think of all this, Nigel? I never knew you were so clever. Why didn't you tell me?" Another man says, "He tried to tell you long ago, but you would not look. He had only got canvas and paint in those days, and you wanted to mend your roof with them. This is what you and your wife used to call Nigel's nonsense, or that dauber." "But it did not look like this then, not real," says Parrish. "No, it was only a glimpse then," says the man. "But you might have caught the glimpse if you had ever thought it worthwhile to try." And then Nigel departs, leaving his tree for the mountains. He was going to learn about sheep, the story continues, and the high pasturages, and look at a wider sky, and walk ever further and further towards the mountains, always uphill. Even little Nigel in his own old home could glimpse the mountains far away, and they got into the borders of his picture. But what they are really like and what lies beyond them, only those can say who have climbed them. Sometime later, there is a conversation held about Nigel's country. "It's proving very useful indeed as a holiday and a refreshment. It is splendid for convalescence, and not only for that, for many it is the best introduction to the mountains. It works wonders in some cases. I'm sending more and more there. They seldom have to come back." I hope the theme of subcreation is clear enough in this story. Nigel's painting is, in a way, Tolkien's own mythological world, of which The Lord of the Rings is only a small part. And by inventing his tree and his country, Nigel continues in his own way the divine creative activity of God himself. What makes this story so thoughtful, though, is the way Nigel's painting is taken up into the eternal. I can't help but assume that Nigel's journey is his death, and his long work afterwards a kind of purgatory. His time then in the countryside, in the company of his completed tree, is curious. I myself think it is the beginning of heaven, the foothills, so to speak, before the divinity proper of the mountains. Tolkien is suggesting that the artist, the sub-creator, is adding to creation, and as such is contributing to heaven itself. I said earlier that the mystic, the poet, and the saint represent most fully the three rival lives that we heirs to the Western intellectual tradition seem forced to decide between, and that reflect the three most important transcendental qualities of truth, beauty, and goodness. Leaf by Nigel is an extraordinary attempt to hold together all three lives and all three transcendentals. Nigel is an artist whose art is mysteriously connected to contemplation, and his active moral life, all the little thankless favors he does for Parrish and his wife, for example, is taken up into the story. Nigel sees after his death that some of the most beautiful leaves of his tree were produced with Parrish's help. His own artistic accomplishment, though he could not see it at the time, is itself inextricably intertwined with his morally virtuous actions. On the other hand, as a sub-creator of a part of heaven, Nigel fashions the very things that will be contemplated by himself and others. He is adding to what we can know and experience, and in this way leading both an active life and a contemplative life. His life is active because it involves genuine making, and the making of things really new and experientially powerful. But since he is a sub-creator and not a creator, he must first draw on creation in order to fashion his own works. And when he has done, what he has made is taken back up into that created order, added to the firmament of heaven as part of the cosmos and therefore a fitting object of wonder. But this taking up and completing of his work is not something he himself can do. Tolkien, like Aquinas, will find his own work completed in heaven, reflected in the mind of God. Perhaps then, if Tolkien is right, when we see God face to face, in him we will also see, miracle of miracles, Tolkien's own stories, Gandalf and Frodo and Bilbo and all the rest, perfected and completed in a way that Tolkien himself might never have imagined. Along with the transcendentals, Jacques Maritain was also fond of what St. Thomas Aquinas called connatural knowledge, knowledge that he considered non-conceptual, deeper in various ways than discursive knowing and reasoning. Such connatural knowledge, wrote Maritain, appears before us under three specifically distinct forms: practical knowledge, which judges both moral matters and the subject itself; poetic knowledge, in which subjectivity and the things of this world are known together in creative intuition; and mystical knowledge, which is not directed towards the subject, but towards things divine, and does not of itself issue in any expression, but in which God is known by union and by connaturality of love. Let the mystic reflect an instant upon himself, and as St. Teresa or as St. John of the Cross will show us to what extent the divine light gives him a lucid and inexhaustible knowledge. Maritain's reference to the Spanish Carmelite, St. Teresa of Avila, is appropriate. I argued before that we need wisdom and poetry and sanctity as equal partners in order to see into the life of things. Likewise, the contemplative stance and the active stance, both artistically and morally, are, so I think, equally necessary in a life well lived. If we were to use Maritain's vocabulary, we would say that each of his three forms of connatural knowledge are interrelated and independent, and the best of lives is a combination of all three, and as such an imitation of God himself. St. Teresa, at the very end of her masterpiece, The Interior Castle, written in 1577, just a few years before her death, concludes that Mary and Martha are not two different forms of life, but instead two different aspects of every well-lived life. "Believe me," she says, "both Martha and Mary must entertain our Lord and keep him as their guest, nor must they be so inhospitable as to offer him no food. You may offer an objection that I said that Mary had chosen the better part, but she had already done Martha's work by waiting on our Lord, by washing his feet, and by wiping them with her hair. Then later, what terrible pain his absence must have caused her during the long years after his crucifixion. You see, she was not always enjoying contemplation at the feet of our Savior." Mary, in the eyes of St. Teresa, lives an active life as well as a contemplative life. Rather than expressing rival forms of human life, the pursuit of truth, beauty, and goodness should be internalized within each person. St. Teresa does not explicitly consider the creative life, but I can't help but think she would be sympathetic to Tolkien's suggestive claims in Leif by Nigel. And if Tolkien is right, part of her joy in heaven comes from the pleasures of Tolkien's Middle Earth. Can beauty save the world? In all honesty, it already has. For if beauty is a transcendental, then God is beauty itself, as well as truth and goodness. And his Son has indeed saved us. And he offers to each of us access to himself through what is true, beautiful, and good. Pope Benedict leaves us with one final question, though. Why does he speak only of art and the saints, and not the mystics or contemplatives or philosophers? I don't think we should be surprised if, as Pope Benedict XVI suggested, art and the saints are the greatest apologetics for the faith. If the three deepest experiences of human knowing are mystical, moral, and poetic, then while mystical knowledge remains in the soul, tending towards silence and terminating in an imminent fruition of the absolute, as Maritain once wrote, moral knowledge expresses itself in a life, and poetic knowledge in a work, things that others can reach out and touch, and through them find their way back to the mysterious source of that knowledge, and then back out again to the created world and its creator. Goodness and beauty provide us in a special way access to the world of the transcendentals, and so to God. And beauty, as the transcendental that holds together truth and goodness, in a way holds an even more precious place in our hearts than goodness. Not because beauty is more important, but because beauty awakens desire, as Tolkien says. It makes us long for things that we only dimly perceive and have not yet begun to strive for. Each of us begins our return to our Creator as true and as good with an experience of beauty. And each of us must try and return to show that beauty to others. Thank you.